For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
So we're in the last week of our two-month spring practice commitment period, and very happy to have Keizan, our Shuso, or head monk for the practice period, giving the talk this morning. So thank you, Keizan.
Bear with me. I've been fighting a little bit of a cough this week, as I'm sure some of you have recently. So for this practice period, as many of you know, we have been studying the teachings of Zen Master Hongzhe from Taigen, our teacher's first book, Cultivating the Empty Field. And there were six practice instructions, these poetic paragraph-long Zen teachings. There are 54 that in the 56. So Taigen selected six for participants and the rest of us to sort of focus on or investigate. And Taigen's given a series of talks about all six, and I've talked about a couple, as well as some other writings from Hongzhe. Taigen asked me specifically this week to talk about a particular line, a particular reference in one of the instructions. It wasn't one of the original six, and I actually won't necessarily read that entire instruction. What I hope to do is read you this passage and investigate in these other selected practice instructions how this idea is unfolded, investigated, explored, filled out, resonated, etc. Make sure I have the right one here. Yes. So actually, I guess it is one of the... Is the Amazing Living Beings, was that one of the six? I don't have it marked as such, but I think you did talk about it. So this reference... Well, let me just read you the line. I'll read you the first couple lines. Our house is a single field, clean, vast, and lustrous. I know why this sounds so familiar, because I talked about this. I think this was my first talk of the practice period. It was about this case, this practice instruction. Our house is a single field, clean, vast, and lustrous, clearly self-illuminated. When the spirit is vacant without conditions, when awareness is serene without cogitation, then Buddhas and ancestors appear and disappear, transforming the world. Amid living beings is the original place of nirvana. So this next line is the key. How amazing it is that all people have this but cannot polish it into bright clarity. So how amazing it is that all people have this but cannot polish it into bright clarity. So this is a direct reference to the Avatamsaka Sutra, a text that's been coming up regularly. Some of you, I know, are investigating it. It's a very important text in our tradition. It's quite an impressive volume that runs somewhere between 1,500, I think, and 2,000 pages in translation. And it's actually, it wasn't from the Buddha's time per se. It's now believed to be a series of separate texts that were kind of woven together over time. Different parts of it actually are studied sometimes separately, treated as separate texts. But there's a particular reference from this text that Hongzhe is making in that line, and it's funny because in true Zen fashion, these references are nested a bit. So this line from the Flower Ornament Sutra, the Avatamsaka Sutra that I was just speaking of, is actually, let me read it to you and then I'll talk a little bit more about it. The line is, a little more background. Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, at his enlightenment, he purportedly sat under the Bo tree and saw the morning star and had a great awakening. And the Avatamsaka, in this account in the Avatamsaka Sutra, he states at that moment, "I now see all sentient beings everywhere fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones, the Buddhas. But because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it." This is a very significant idea and characterizes the flavor of what we sometimes refer to as Mahayana Buddhism, or it's a Buddhist understanding that developed over time, in which it's perceived that this Buddha nature is not some special state that through our arduous activity we achieve, but rather it's our natural inherent state that through our practice that we just engaged in this morning through Zazen and this activity of getting ourselves arranged in the morning and getting ourselves to the Zen meditation space and engaging together in this practice, through this activity we're actually expressing, invoking, actualizing this inherent capacity for awakening. So that's what this idea, this is a really beautiful expression of that idea, and it's very foundational. And in fact, it's so foundational that it's the first thing that the Buddha utters. According to the Avatamsaka Sutra, it's the first thing he utters when he really sees to the bottom of our human condition. So it's really quite reassuring in a lot of ways. So the other reference that this is making is there's a collection of Buddhist, it's kind of a top 100 of Buddhist teachings compiled by Hongzhe, the author of these teachings, in a book called The Book of Serenity. These snippets of teaching are called koans. There are some different collections of koans, but the Book of Serenity is among the two or three best known and used across different Zen schools, not just the Soto school, although it's very central to our practice. So Hongzhe is referencing it in the Book of Serenity, and then he's referencing it in these practice instructions. So I thought I'd go through some of the other practice instructions and show other ways in which he's maybe unfolding this understanding for us a little bit. I think that these teachings, as many of you are already aware, they're very holographic. And I think we could take virtually any line in this entire corpus of teachings and in some way reveal its relationship to this idea of kind of our inherent Buddha nature, we might say. I was just thinking a little bit earlier, there's a wonderful 18th century, I believe he's 18th century Zen teacher, Zen iconoclast in Japan named Bankei. And he sort of put it this way. He said that we have an unborn Buddha nature, an unborn Buddha mind that is inherent and natural to us. It's freely functioning. It's ungraspable, but also unshakable. And that we trade it in. We trade in our unborn Buddha mind for delusion. We trade it in. So his instruction was basically, just don't trade it in. Just don't trade it in. Don't trade it over. Don't hand it over for this counterfeit of confusion and delusion. So it's another kind of take, but let's see what else Hongzhe has to say. I jotted down one last line that I'll read here before we move forward, that I wrote that there's a sense in this line of celebrating and enacting inherent intelligence, clarity, capacity, possibility, and fitness, which I underlined, for and with things as it is. Things as it is a line from Suzuki Roshi about just the natural goodness of our lives and our world. Things as it is are just good. And we can meet that with, you know, fitness. We have a fitness. We have an inherent fitness and capacity to respond to our lives with compassion and wisdom. But this is in contrast to the sensation that we often have where we feel alienated from that capacity or divorced from it. And maybe it's that feeling of alienation, that feeling of being divorced from it, that brings us to practice. I think that's always some component of our relationship with practice, whether, you know, at the beginning or what keeps us coming and keeps us investigating, is that we see how easily we trade in the recognition of our fitness, the experience of our inherent wisdom. We see how we quite naturally or unnaturally, we fabricated these habits, as Hongzhe says, for trading that in, trading that over. So let's look at some of these other lines. So the first practice instruction, for those of you following in the book, it's on page 30, the practice of true reality. And actually, maybe I didn't do that one. Let's go to page 38. That's all right. I'll just look here. The practice of true reality is simply to sit serenely in silent introspection. When you have fathomed this, you cannot be turned around by external causes and conditions. So there's that same idea. It's very matter of fact, it's very direct, it's very simple. This is certainly echoed throughout our teaching and really underscored by our founder in Japan, Eihei Dogen, in the 13th century, who said that just as we did this morning, we come in, we arrange ourselves, we arrange our cushions, we arrange ourselves on our cushions, and we automatically experience, whether we realize it or not, we automatically not only experience, but we actually enact and invoke this inherent capacity of awakened responsiveness. So the practice of true reality is simply to sit serenely in silent introspection. So we don't come in and we don't have a whole agenda or a program. This is not guided meditation, in case you didn't notice. We just sit. We try to keep ourselves upright and composed and experience it. It's quite direct. When you have fathomed this, you cannot be turned around by external causes and conditions. So that's kind of our work, isn't it? That we desire, we long to fathom this. Fathom, I like this idea of, you know, fathom is a measurement of depth in the ocean. We wish to sort of really, really immerse ourselves and go deep into these teachings so that it's a little bit steadier. We're not as easily shaken. We're not as easily tempted to trade in our Buddha mind for greed, hate, and delusion. These threats that are spoken of in the teaching. All right, on page 38, in How to Contemplate Buddha, Hongzhe says, contemplating your own authentic form is how to contemplate Buddha. If you can experience yourself without distractions, simply surpass partiality and go beyond conceptualizing. So contemplating your own authentic form is how to contemplate Buddha. Of course, this echoes or presages Dogen's formulation of to study Buddha is to study the self. This is in Genjo Koan, maybe the most famous passage of Dogen. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by or actualized by all things. So I really, this word authentic has been very operative for me throughout my life. This desire to be authentic. I think there's ways in which it's generational. I've been very aware in the last few years of being Generation X. You know, when I was a younger person, I thought, kind of it's a Gen X sort of thought, that I was somehow not a part of a generation, just free floating, sort of slightly alienated and existential and kind of angsty, just like, you know, many of the great bands of that era. We sadly lost Chris Cornell recently, who apparently lost his fight with, you know, some of his angst. The singer from Soundgarden. So, this Gen X kind of angstiness and the desire for authenticity, because we've come up in this age of incomprehensible manipulation, and as a young person, I was very aware of. No, you couldn't turn anywhere, and it's, you know, in many ways it's 10 times worse now, but the sense of you're just constantly being sold. I was referencing the other day with Tigan this great line from the movie Say Anything. You remember that with John Cusack? Really great kind of generational defining movie. And John Cusack, it's the one where he holds the boombox over his head under his girlfriend's window to win her back, playing Peter Gabriel. But he goes to dinner with her dad, who's real skeptical. And he's like, well, young man, what do you want to do with yourself? And he says something along the lines, well, sir, I don't really know. I don't want to make anything that's sold, and I don't want to sell anything that's made, and I don't want to do anything that can be corporatized. And, you know, he just kind of goes on. It doesn't leave you a lot of wiggle room. It's just this longing for authenticity. This certainly shaped my impetus towards practice. I thought, well, maybe if I do this, I'll find it. I'll get to the ground through the maze of corporatized manipulation. That's one way to think about it. But I think what he's talking about here is something that's, again, very fundamental and authentically possible to experience in this very, very simple practice that we have. So let's go to another one. So the next case is on page 43. All beings are your ancestors. Again, I'm just going to kind of focus on single lines. You know, you're welcome to go back and review these. It might be a good idea to go back and review or look through any of these cases and see through this lens of the Buddha's statement at awakening. How amazing it is that we have this capacity, but we trade it in. So the line here is transforming according to circumstances. Meet all beings as your ancestors. So this, I think I chose this line because it has this this sensation of the active component of this, that we don't sort of wake up to this and then move as this, we don't discover this primal authenticity and then move unchanging through the world. I think at some level, maybe we expect that to happen. I think at some level, psychologically, we're often really wishing that we could change or transform ourselves. There's a real trap there in our practice that if we're not careful, we're using our practice in a kind of abusive way towards ourselves, that we're not allowing for this complexity inherent in our beingness, our unfathomable complexity. So this line indicates that we can employ this complexity as a transforming function, that we respond to conditions. Tigan often references how through practice we actually cultivate responsibility. So we cultivate the ability to respond in different complex situations without necessarily trading in this authentic capacity for that false sense of ignorance, anger, greed. So seeing all beings as your ancestors, I sort of like this too, because in the Soto teachings, there's not a lot of talk of, you know, just become one and see all beings as Buddha. And that gets said too in other places, but I like this, that it's, there's an emphasis in the Soto teachings about the particularity, that things are complex and multifarious, and that we are complex and multifoiled, and that we can live in this complexity with sincerity. And so I like this idea that we meet beings as ancestors. So we could say, you see all beings as God. You know, we could say that. We could see all beings as an expression of the oneness. And that's really nice. But for me, that there's a little bit of an abstraction there. This phrase, seeing them as your ancestors, it's got a little more resonance for me. I feel like I can plug into that as an instruction. The Tibetans say, see all beings as your mother. You know, see as a past mother. Every being has been your mother at some point. That's nice too. But it's a sense of this kind of particularity. So I can look across and see Michael or Sid, and I can imagine them as ancestral teachers. That's pretty easy. Maybe easier than seeing them as elements of some abstract oneness or something. I don't know. It's just an idea to play with. And the other note I made here is that it actually even allows for eccentricity. So we read about these ancestors. If we really study who the Zen ancestors were, as we did in Rohatsu Sesshin last year, we were talking, Taigen was talking about the first four, five, six ancestors in our lineage in China. And they are not paragons of virtue from the beginning. They're lepers, criminals, half crazy people. They have psychological issues. That's what drove their search to kind of figure stuff out. They're eccentric people, and if you hang around Zen people enough, you start to realize these are eccentric types. And that eccentricity almost emerges more through our practice. We get more particular as we get more intimate with the sense of things being connected. It's kind of paradoxical and quite interesting. But we don't embroider the edges. That's another line. We don't put lipstick on the pig, as it were. We don't add extra. So in a traditional training temple, we might all be wearing robes with shaved heads so that we all kind of look the same. Suzuki Roshi used to say, I would like to see you all shave your head so that I can see how you're different. Which is kind of nice, you know. Everybody wear robes and shave your head so that we can express our difference. It's not how we normally maybe think about it. Maybe not our conventional view walking in off the street. All right, page 44, the next one. Oh, this is a nice line. Drop off your skin and accept your function. I have a note here that it references steady natural practice without edges or seams. Let's see, where does this? Yeah. In daytime, the sun, at night, the moon, each in turn does not blind the other. This is how a patched robe monk or a Zen practitioner steadily practices, naturally without edges or seams. So, again, the sense of awakening being natural, not some imposed ideal, but it just naturally emerges as we engage the practice. So we come here and we sit, and no matter how our zazen felt or looks, it was quite natural. It was quite natural to our being. So we're really engaging in a practice of appreciation. And it's natural and steady. Those words are almost the bedrock of our Soto way of practice, that it's we're aiming towards steadiness and naturalness. And that takes time. That takes hours, a lot of hours. And I think it also takes a teacher. I think it also takes a context to practice. So, you know, I commend you all for having the courage to come and engage in this activity, which I think to most people walking in off the street might seem a little eccentric. Can I grab your watch, Taigen, so I'm aware? When should we end for question? All right, go a few more minutes. I could stop at any point and we're fine. But there's some more lines, so let's keep looking. 49. There's just these last two instructions, actually. Investigating wonder, which is a really wonderful teaching. Even the title is really great. Spiritual energy shines on its own. Let me find that line. In clarity, the wonder exists, with spiritual energy shining on its own. So again, this idea that this is something inherent, that we don't have to fabricate or manufacture or embroider. We sit and it is already there waiting for us. It's already there waiting, radiating. But we may not experience that right away. And we may not experience it in every single particular moment. But this is an ongoing practice. It's oriented for a lifetime. Again, it's this idea that we're not coming to build some Buddha out of what we are, but rather to celebrate and invoke the Buddha that already is occurring, and participate with it. So in clarity, the wonder exists with spiritual energy shining on its own. That's the kind of sense of grace. But I like with Zazen, this is my real, one of the aspects that I really love about Zazen, that we don't have to wait around. We don't have to wait around for it to kind of descend on us. That we can come and we can engage in these practices, and it's just kind of naturally, spontaneously present and aware and palpable. And if you're not experiencing it right now, maybe you experienced it during Zazen, and maybe you'll experience it later during work practice or during talking with each other over tea and cookies. You know, there's this kind of natural way. And then, or maybe you won't experience it now, and this will be, you'll be wishing you're somewhere else, but then you'll be somewhere else later and you'll feel a little refreshed. That's certainly something, a quality that I see emerging in my engagement with practice. So the last one, page 55, graciously share yourself. I guess this line speaks to this. You must know there is a path on which to turn yourself around. So respond with brilliant light to such unfathomable depths as the waters of autumn or the moon stamped in the sky. Then you must know there is a path on which to turn yourself around. When you do turn yourself around, you have no different face that can be recognized. The friend of mine is runs two businesses in Albuquerque, my home now, and one of them is a rug restoration, and basically a rug restoration business. He really specializes in Navajo rugs. But he also has a kind of a boutique, a men's boutique. So he sells men's clothes. But he just got in some vintage Navajo jewelry. And they're all swastikas. He put a picture of it. So swastikas, of course, it's that symbol, which is quite ubiquitous all around the world for cultures for millennia, as a religious symbol, of course, was co-opted by the Nazis and kind of poisoned. But just to talk about this a little bit, they can be facing two ways. They can be going clockwise or counterclockwise. So the Nazi one goes counterclockwise. But that counterclockwise in the Buddhist tradition, in some of these other traditions, that's actually turning. Well, it's what we do when we come in and we turn around the light to shine within. We sort of turn our backs to the world and we turn towards the wall. We turn within. That's this kind of counter movement of renunciation. And then we turn back around and the wheel turns the other way and we go into the world with sharing hands. So this sense of there being a path on which to turn yourself around. I like symbols. As an artist, I'm fascinated by these symbols. So this idea that you can symbolize this turning around and then symbolize turning back. Turning within and then turning out. and that there's a path for us to do this. There is a way in which we can engage this. We don't have to make it up by ourselves. There's a sense in which we have to investigate it for ourselves, but there's a well-worn method or methods of investigating ourselves. And I often think of Zazen, you know, we come and we listen to Zazen. We don't do Zazen. We don't tell Zazen what it should be. We listen to Zazen. We listen to the ancestors. We listen to these teachings. And we participate with humility, but also courage. So a lot of different ideas. So, but again, just to bring it back around, they're all ways in which we're investigating this central idea that this awakening is inherent and natural to our very humanity and our very functioning in the world with each other. And we're really here just celebrating that. So thank you for coming and celebrating. Thank you for all of you who've participated in the practice period thus far. And we have another week, so I hope we can really, really harness another line in here. Anja talks about riding, mounting and riding sounds and colors. Maybe we can mount and ride the sort of momentum of serenity that hopefully we're experiencing through this period of concentrated practice. So thank you very much. If there are any questions or comments, please share freely. Yeah.
So I was thinking about that line, when I heard it, when I first read it, it seemed to say to me, you're a good person deep down. So there's definitely a virtue thing to it, you know. If you got rid of all your bad temperedness from whatever, there'd be this sweet, kind person inside. And I guess I'd be feeling a little bad because I was very bad tempered with somebody yesterday in the store, and afterwards I was really being upright and I felt really ashamed. But I think that I get confused between, or listening to you and thinking about how nothing you were saying was about being kind or about saving people or about being more generous or virtuous. You know, it was about being more authentic. And today when I was meditating, I'm like, so is my authentic self really that kind, warm self, or is it that reptilian brain that basically is, that is out to protect myself, you know, and isn't becoming more virtuous, sort of a higher, less authentic and more learned behavior that I have to develop. And when I was reading Being Upright, you know, and he's talking about how being, seeing the goodness in ourselves is nothing to do with virtue. And so, you know, I'm just struggling with that and realizing how much my sense of religion or of all of this is about becoming a nicer person. And how much it feels like everything you were talking about really didn't have a whole lot to do with, maybe, I don't know, when I hear things like authentic and becoming like Buddha, that to me sounds like he's saying we're, so anyway, that's enough.
Yeah, those are really good points. For some reason I'm thinking of this show that I was spending some time in bed this week, sick with this cold, which happily kind of blew through, and I'm kind of on the tail end now. It was called The Last Kingdom, and it's about the Anglo-Saxon Dane Wars in the 9th century in England. And the central character is this Anglo-Saxon who was kidnapped and raised as a Dane. As a child, interesting resonance with many other mythic sort of stories. And anyway, the Anglo-Saxons, and I was reading that the show is apparently quite historically accurate in many ways, but the Anglo-Saxons were, even then, uptight, puritanical, and obsessed with these ideas of virtue and kind of imposed morality, where this Dane, you know, this Anglo-Saxon who was raised as a Dane, he's the hero, and it's all cartoon-like, but he's very natural, and he's very authentically himself, and he's a pagan. He refuses to become Christianized or re-Christianized, and he just sort of moves through the world authentically. He bangs around a lot. He hurts people's feelings. He breaks hearts. But he never makes the mistake of being priggish or uptight or imposing, you know, thinking that other people should be behaving differently. So, I think we have to investigate that. What does that mean? What does it mean that we're authentic and good? Because we want to be good. We really do. And we're here. Everybody here doesn't like conflict. You're here because you're turned in the right direction. So you don't like conflict. You don't like pissing people off, excuse me. You don't like stepping on their toes. You don't like pushing them around. You don't like being pushed around. But we're human beings, and we have been raised in causes and conditions where, you know, maybe we've been turned around. What does George Harrison say? You've been perverted and inverted too. What is that? My Guitar Gently Weeps? Is that what that is?
Yeah.
I don't know how. I don't know how you were inverted, perverted, you were inverted too. You know that line?
I just wonder if it's really, you know, I think, so then I was thinking about the Christian, it's sort of like you're a child, there's not that expectation that you're already naturally good. But it almost sounds like we're dealing with a little bit of telling ourselves, well, we just get deep enough, we're naturally good. Work goes into, but except that we're all sitting like crazy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, at a certain point, I think, you know, there's work to be done in the therapy room with the therapist couch, and then that interpersonal stuff. I think it's really important, but that's not sort of our focus in the practice space. I think we come in and we just do this and trust. So there's a lot of trust. You know, and I'm very thankful for this context, not necessarily, even though it can appear to indicate that we should be better people and behave differently than we do, and we work on it, but we don't have to employ a bunch of labels or programs, you know. We just sort of engage on it and allow it to work on us. We work on it. It works with us, supports us. But I found a lot of benefit in, you know, some 12-step work and that kind of thing.
I think I'm just questioning the author.
Yeah.
Michael.
Yeah, Michael.
Part of it is just from the answer, or mostly a draft from the answers I gave to someone's question about that specific line. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I took away from it was that the idea of the authentic self is less a, you know, cutting away at things down to some quintessential aspect, but more a realization of the endless possibility of self, you know, including all the aspects of yourself that you wish you or you think you need to cut away to get to the authentic aspect of yourself. But I think some of that is, or some of that, like, possibility is why I trade in my realization for delusion, because I'm afraid of it a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's it's unfamiliar. But I'm comforted by that idea of shaking my head and wearing a robe to see how we're all different, and that what I think of as possibility is a little more about just like my heart than it is, you know, like what kind of job I have or like what, you know, I get lost in like what I think of as possible for myself and really these external things. And then it's more of an expression or a kind of reaction or something like that.
I think this question that Caroline's bringing up is really excellent and important. So to talk about being authentic, as Kazan has, is very important and central for us. But that doesn't mean that there's not an ethical component to our practice. Mm-hmm. We want to be helpful rather than harmful, and we have the precepts. But part of what I think you were pointing to is that we get caught in kind of judgmentalism and imposed sense of morality that maybe isn't natural and authentic. And so, anyway, I don't want to end or settle that this discussion, but to explore how the authentic self actually does want to be helpful and kind. I think they're not in conflict essentially, but there's an inspiration to do there.
And we have a practice period participant discussion, so let's investigate this some more, I think, this afternoon. I think that'd be wonderful. Yeah. Nicholas.
Thanks so much for your talk.
You're welcome.
So much in there. I'm looking forward to listening to it again. Things that occurred to me is that absent my thinking, I feel like I'm in touch with my Buddha nature. Problem is, I'm always thinking.
Poor God.
And that's how reading Buddha manifests. On the river of thoughts, you know, always with some sort of obsessive thinking or whatever, but it's always you thinking. And so what I'm trying to do is to really pay attention to the space between the thoughts. Also, I've been playing with really playing with that and just being in the form of the zazen, and just really kind of settling into that.
Well, the thing that comes up for me, thanks for your comment, in that was just a semantical shift from I am always thinking to there often appears to be thinking occurring, you know, like we can kind of just shift our language around stuff, which can help shift our view. And I think bringing it back to Zazen is a very important aspect in that in Zazen, we don't consider ourselves thinking. We witness that there may be thinking occurring. I often use this metaphor of pushing in the clutch. For those of us who know how to drive stick shifts, you push in the clutch, and that, what that means is that the gears separate. They spin, but they aren't engaged. So we're allowing the wheels to just spin, and then eventually they slow down. But just that shift from I am the thinker and I am a problem with my thinking to thinking is occurring or behavior is occurring, and I can see that and take that into Zazen.
I think that's really the tension because we, you know, originally we are, you know, everything and nothing in particular. You know, we have all the possibilities, we inherit all of the conditioning, we're the sum of all the conditions that are arising now, but we do have this, you know, wish we're capable of recognizing the universal, but we only, you know, but we live in the world of the particular phenomenon, so we have to, you know, figure out how to manage that in every moment. And I do think there's an element of vow in that, that we, you know, maybe make a decision about something. So it's not, you know, to just completely be authentic, we contain every possibility. So when I think of, you know, how we're maybe authentically good, I think that it's maybe just, you know, that there's good in the sense of fitting, that there's a reason for everything that's there. And maybe we can understand that or maybe we can't. But I think it is hard to, you know, figure out how to interact with all those causes and conditions without trading in our awareness of Buddha nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I can quote, and these will be my final comments, I think we need to wrap, but to quote another song lyric, there are even some evil mothers who think that everything is just dirt. It's a Velvet Underground song. This orientation that brings us back to this original teaching, which is that we really are inherently awakening beings. There really is fundamentally this thing that is sane and good, and these words already, they start to create these polarities, but that there is an inherent thing that we're all here celebrating today and invoking. And this is, I often think of this line, good news, you know, to borrow from that other tradition. And that we can come and we can engage in it and get a taste of that. And so many people, this is our vow, is that they don't have access, you know. They think they don't have access, that they're caught up in these, you know, just walk out into the street, you know. Obviously, we are in some way committed to being better people and help being a force for support and care in the world, or we wouldn't be here. So that's an inherent kind of thing. But vow is such an important idea, and it's about that orientation too. You know, we're really oriented by a vow to support this awakening. So if we just keep reorienting ourselves, you know, we go off and then we come back, and we go off and then we come back, and you know, it's just zazen. So please enjoy your zazen, please enjoy your inhale and your exhale.